Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.
This is True Crime Cast. Jamie here with John, who is alive.
I'm alive. I don't sound like myself, but I am alive. How are you, man?
I'm doing really well. Thankfully, I've avoided catching anything from you in case you, or I don't remember how much we talked about it on True Crime to Go. We talked about it a little more on our Patreon episode, but John's had COVID, so he's been not only in quarantine, but really sick. So I'm glad you're better.
Yeah, I mean, I'm good. I was never hospitalized or anything close to that. For some reason, when I was in college, I had pneumonia one time. It was the worst I've ever felt. And ever since then, anytime I get sick, it always goes to my lungs.
Yeah.
And I've kind of made peace with God that if I die, it's probably going to be lung related. I felt close on Wednesday of last week.
Yeah, you've been in rough shape, and our Patreon episode was recorded over Zoom.
And I know that didn't sound great, and it was a few hours later than normal, so thank you for your patience, guys, and we'll do better next month.
Well,
I mean, it wasn't like I planned to get COVID.
Right, and I feel like it didn't sound great, but I don't know how much of that was over Zoom or how much of that was just your voice now that I'm here with you.
Yeah, it was probably a healthy mix of both.
Yeah. Again, that case exclusive to Patreon supporters, it's not in any podcast that I know of. Fantastic story. Great reason to join Patreon. A kidnapped deer leading back to a murder with three people arrested and connections to a city in Pennsylvania when this all happened in the South. So fascinating.
Really fascinating story. Again, that's only available on Patreon. I do have a couple of Patreon folks to thank. Some people joined us over on Patreon. We have Lori, who joined, according to my app, 20 hours ago. So fresh off the block. And also Damon joined at the $3 level. So thank you guys for coming in. Joining us on Patreon.
There are 66 episodes over there that you've never heard from us.
Yep. If you have never joined, those are exclusive. And we add one each and every month. We also put up early and ad-free content when we can from our main feed, so you all can have that too.
By when we can, he means always except when he has COVID.
That's true. I just want to put that caveat in there legally.
Yeah. It's not a guarantee. It is conditional somewhat, but
should we just go ahead and say that we're not going to, no, I'm not going to say that. We'll do our best to post on the first of the month, a new Patreon episode. Sometimes life happens and somebody ends up with COVID.
It was still in the first. It just wasn't in the morning, which is fine.
We pride ourselves in punctuality.
We do, and it's been a rough week, but we're back on top of it. And want to give another shout out to a podcast that is fairly newly launched, but you're going to love. It's called The Outlier Podcast. It's hosted by independent reporter Lauren Conlon, who's been a guest on our show before. And it's a new show that she's created focused on pop culture and true crime. The show features everything from celebrity interviews and storytelling to true crime coverage with key players and experts. Lauren's not afraid to speak her mind and cover the story even when nobody else will. Again, this is called The Outlier Podcast, and you can find it wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Lauren has made a guest appearance on our show, and we had such a good time. Love her work that she's done on covering Grant Solomon, so go check out her new podcast. I'm sure you're going to love it.
Guys, we have our third consecutive college-related story, and we were joking off the air that all of these took place either right before or during our college years.
Yeah, it really took me back. Like, in a minute, we're going to talk about a specific date, and I remember where I was, what I was doing. It was a long time ago, dude.
It really was, but it makes it more real to us, I think, that we were in a similar place. And this is our third consecutive college student case. And they're all very different, and this is a fascinating one.
All right, man. Get the ball rolling.
As of today, there are 21 binders full of information on Cindy Song in Pennsylvania's Ferguson Township Police Department. That's one binder for every year that she lived before she went missing. So who's Cindy Song? She was born Hyung John Song on February 25th, 1980, in South Korea. She had spent most of her life in South Korea, but in 1995, when she was a teenager, she moved in with relatives in the States in Virginia. She finished high school there and was accepted into Pennsylvania State University, most referred to as Penn State, home of the Nittany Lions, known for football and some scandals, but also known as a really good school.
In college, she was going to major in a rigorous program called Integrative Arts. What is Integrative Arts, Jamie? You worked at a college. Did you all have any degrees like this?
No, not like this. This was a very unique degree. I've worked at several colleges. I work with colleges now in my day job and don't see a lot of this, but basically it combined various sciences with engineering, with communications. It's basically making a well-rounded individual ready to make an immediate impact on the engineering or research world when they get out.
That's awesome. And that was something I certainly wasn't doing in 2001. It was a student-led program where Cindy created her own curriculum. And this program was meant to be difficult. In between classes, Cindy worked two part-time jobs and was part of the Korean Undergraduate Student Association, the American Red Cross, and the Advertising Club. Girl was busy. I mean, look, that was a rigorous academic caseload anyway, but then you add on two jobs and all these extracurricular stuff. Dude, like, I'm stressed out for her.
Yeah, ambitious, busy, and thriving.
Yeah, she had dreams, man. She wanted to work in the fashion industry. She wanted to do some graphic design. And I mean, it sounds like she was well on her way and very, very capable.
She was. And graphic design, if you think about it, at the time, this was 2001, was still not a huge industry. So she was ready to make her mark on the world.
Dude, you could have got in, like, that was like ground level stuff. She could have been absolutely killing it in that.
In October of 2001, which was my first semester of college, Cindy was starting her senior year. And she was excited to graduate and start life on her own. But even the hardest working students deserve a night off. And I really can't emphasize that enough. I advised students for over a decade and in talking to them, it's so important to take some time for yourself to keep yourself healthy, not only physically, but also emotionally and mentally. And Cindy was very hardworking and she had planned herself a night out on Halloween with her two friends, Stacy Polk and Lisa Kim. They decided to go to a costume party at the Players Nightclub. It was a nearby spot that was really primarily created and run for Penn State students. Cindy put together a bunny costume with a white tennis shirt, a pink top, bunny ears, and a makeshift cottontail. The friends stayed out drinking and dancing and having a good time until around 2 a.m. So a typical night out for college students. She just happened to be dressed like a bunny and at a costume party. When they were done at the club, they went back to a friend's house and were set to play video games for a couple of hours, which was usually my night to myself, was playing video games, didn't spend a lot of time going out.
2001 had some great video games. Like, yeah. That was at the prime of my video game playing self.
Yeah, we played a lot of Nintendo 64, but the next gen systems were also out. That was when Halo was becoming big, the original Halo.
I feel like I had a PlayStation 2 back then.
Yep, that was about the same time. Cindy and her friends played again for a couple hours, and they dropped her off at 4 a.m. outside of her apartment complex. They watched her walk toward her building, and they went ahead and drove off.
So later that day, Cindy's roommate came home, and the front door was locked from the outside and nothing looked out of place. She did notice that Cindy wasn't home, but really didn't think anything about it. I mean, I've already talked about how busy Cindy was. She had a very busy schedule and it was common for people not to see her for a few days at a time. But when she didn't show up for one of her jobs and she didn't pick up her phone, that's when people started to worry. Cindy's friends called the police on November 4th, 2001, 3 days after the last time they saw her.
And again, John, you mentioned that it was common for people not to see her. That was also early cell phone years. It was common not to talk to people for a long time. We think now that we can track people with apps. We get instant responses to texts. You probably could text back then, but it was going to cost you a lot of money, and you had to type on the T9 texting system, so it took you forever to send a message.
This was not like a, I don't know, I had a cell phone a little bit later, like 2002, I think, is when I probably got my first one. And I really viewed it as like, this is an emergency. This is not a how I keep track of my friend's situation. Does that make sense?
Like, oh yeah, absolutely.
It was almost like a, like booster cables in my car. It's there if I need it, but I'm still tethered to a phone, like a corded phone.
Yeah. And so it was very common to just not speak to people for a few days. And you didn't even think twice about it at the time. So when she was reported missing, obviously it had already been 3 days. So police went ahead and opened a missing person file and started looking for Cindy. And first they went to her apartment and they found that nearly all of her personal belongings were there. She had made it inside the night her friends dropped her off because the fake eyelashes that were part of her costume were in her bedroom. And the backpack that she took with her was also in the apartment. So if you're thinking that they watched her walk away and she was kidnapped before she got to the door, that's not the situation. But the rest of the bunny costume was missing. So the assumption is that Cindy got into the apartment, started to take the costume off, but didn't get everything taken off before whatever happened, happened. The only thing missing from the apartment were Cindy's keys and purse. And that contained her driver's license and her credit cards and everything else that she needed to live life. She even left behind her phone, which again was very much for emergencies, but she was also known to never leave that at her apartment. She kept it with her all the time. So the police started going through the phone. It had been turned off, which again, now you're not going to turn your phone off. You may miss something in the 3 seconds that it takes it to boot back up, but then you would turn it off. A lot of times you would turn it off to charge it so that it would charge faster. When they turned it back on, they saw that no calls had been made and no calls had been received since she'd been dropped off at 4 a.m. that day. She didn't have any emails in her inbox. There was no indication in the apartment of a break-in or of a struggle of any kind. And there's never been any activity on any of the credit cards that were inside her purse that night. So it's like her keys and purse disappeared, and none of it ever made an impact after that.
So investigators had to look into this case, and their first theory involved that she simply ran off. Now, she had recently gone through a breakup with her boyfriend that she was living with. Her family wondered if she had chosen to leave or commit suicide over it. But her friends and her roommate say Cindy was taking steps to get over the breakup. She was in therapy. She was taking medication to get through it. They also insisted that she was not the type of person to ever run away from something. In her room, there were Britney Spears concert tickets for the following week and a receipt for a new computer that was being delivered. So, you know, why they're speculating like she had things she was looking forward to. It doesn't make sense for her just to leave all that behind. From all accounts, she was happy and planning for the rest of her time in college and after college, and the police didn't believe that she had just ran away.
Which is usually the first thing. Let's rule that out, and then we can start picking up clues. If she didn't run away, maybe what happened? Because that happens very often. But you're right, we don't see people actively leaving things behind often that they're obviously looking forward to. But the police did have some other theories, and we'll get into that after we get back from the break and see how they went about searching for Cindy Song.
We've only communicated via text.
Don't tell them it's a wrong number. Have some fun with it. Play along.
You don't know who you have really been messing with.
Why would you have a duffel bag full of cash?
you're not so big and bad when you're not behind your phone.
Next time you may not make it out alive.
You don't work here.
Stop, Nick.
Freeze. Drop the bag and get on the ground.
One thing at a time. First, the gash.
You know you're not the only option I have, right?
You're behind this whole thing, aren't you?
No, this wasn't supposed to happen.
It's over for you.
No, 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 no.
Why is this happening?
From the makers of True Crime Cast, find the fictional mystery Left on Dead wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
Cindy's friends told police that there was a nearby 24-hour store, like a 7-Eleven type store, if you will, that she was known to go to at all hours. She would just head over and get a snack to continue studying, go grab some coffee, what have you. So police started to think that maybe Cindy had come home at 4 a.m., taken some of her costume off, realized that she may not have been going ready to go to sleep or that she needed something from the store, so she went out to it. And on her way to or from that store, she was potentially abducted. So they decided that they would search the area in case she was abducted and, God forbid, dragged into the woods and hurt. But this was 2001. They didn't have GPS tracking. They didn't have social media. And even if they did, she didn't have her phone with her. So they were searching blind. They thought, maybe she's here, maybe she's not. We don't know really which route she would have taken or where a potential assailant would have taken her. When they did this search, there was no sign of Cindy. They searched the woods nearby, the streets and the buildings, and eventually her family came over from South Korea to help in the search. They got to the United States and they were given immediate access to Cindy's apartment when they made a mistake. And I think it's a mistake a lot of people would make. They came in and cleaned up her apartment. They wanted to feel like they were being useful, which I totally get. I see my parents and in-laws doing this when they come visit. They want to help. They want to do something. And since Cindy's family felt helpless at the time looking for their daughter, they decided to clean everything up so it was tidy when she got back. But they ended up destroying any potential evidence if she had in fact been abducted from the apartment.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. There is potential there. In my mind, it's also possible that she got home, she wanted to just take off her stuff and get, you know, a few hours of sleep before she went on. In my mind, it almost looks as if she needed to run to that convenience store just real quick. So she just grabbed her purse real quick, got out of there, and then never came back. So it's also possible they didn't destroy anything.
Absolutely.
But we'll never know.
Yeah, you always like to have the evidence available just in case. But they had not declared it a crime scene, and they hadn't told anybody not to clean. So
yeah, I wish that.
Certainly, you know, don't blame them for doing that, but it is a part of the story.
On TV, in those situations, they have that tape on the door to not let people in, and you can see if the tape's been moved or tampered with. Like, you'd have loved to see a situation like that where nobody's allowed in or out until it's processed.
But she had been missing for days, and they didn't think her apartment was where it happened. There was no evidence to indicate where it was. So I don't know that they would block her entire life off at that point. I don't know if that would make sense. Obviously, in retrospect, you kind of wish they would. But at the time, I think they probably made the right call.
Yeah. A few days after she went missing, investigators got a strange tip. There was a woman in Philadelphia. This is nearly 200 miles away from Cindy's apartment. This woman claimed that she saw a woman that looked like Cindy in a vehicle with an unidentified male in the city's Chinatown area. Now, the witness said that the woman called for help, but the man intervened and told the witness to leave. They created a sketch from this woman's description and released it to the media, and they said that this man is not a suspect, but someone that police wanted to talk to. No one ever came forward, and investigators said that this witness story changed several times. They were never able to verify this woman's statements, but it did keep Cindy's story
in the spotlight.
Yeah, I know people, again, want to help, but reporting sightings that are not reliable really does bog down the investigation, and it takes up resources that could be used in better leads. And not to say this may have been Cindy, we don't know, but with the woman being very unsure of what was happening, maybe you don't call in if you think you might have sort of seen Cindy at some point. On January 31st, again, this is about 3 months after Cindy had disappeared, an on-campus coalition dedicated to finding Cindy Song held a press conference. In this press conference, they were very critical of the Ferguson Township Police Department for not doing enough, in their opinion, to solve this case. They compared Cindy's case to one where a local 13-year-old white girl had gone missing on New Year's Day, and there were 50 FBI agents in town on that case. And this wasn't something we talked about a lot in 2001. We'll talk about it more now, but missing white girls on TV, like, they get all the publicity. And so much publicity that a lot of other stories kind of get buried, unfortunately, in looking for these individuals. And that's the stereotype that's out there. Cindy's case was initially run by just one investigator. They did organize a search. They did investigate. But you can look at the comparison there. Again, Cindy was an adult. It's a different situation, but the visual is not good. It was extended to a team of 6 state police officers after public pressure from Penn State's Black Caucus and Korean Undergraduate Students Association continued to make it known that they were not satisfied with this investigation. And colleges and universities is where activism kind of breeds and lives. So for them to take this cause up for Cindy, one of their own who contributed so much to campus, is not a surprise to me at all. And to see that it actually made a difference and got more people assigned to the case shows that they were right and it was deserved to have more attention.
There would be months where there were no leads at all. And a year after Cindy disappeared, her case was featured on an episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I guarantee I watched it.
Absolutely.
Now, this renewed interest in the case. And in 2003, they got the biggest break of the case so far. A police informant named Paul Weekly came forward and said that Hugo Selinsky murdered Cindy with the help of a man named Michael Kirkowski. Selinsky was a convicted bank robber and a serial killer, and Kirkowski was a pharmacist who also ran an illegal drug ring. Dude, like, I remember their names from the media that long ago.
Yeah, and I giggled a little bit when you said Paul Weekly was a police informant. That makes me think of
Weasel.
The term we use is prison snitch. I was thinking weasel, squeak. Like, it seems like the name of somebody who is going to run to police.
We have a witness protection joke in our town. There's a pastor whose last name is Living Good.
Yeah.
And I feel like that has to be made up.
Has to be.
So I think Paul Weekly's would have been too. Anyway, Weekly told police that the two men saw Cindy walking in her costume that night and they mistook her for a sex worker. It's after hours, and by after hours, I mean, it's late in the middle of the night. It's a single woman walking alone dressed up as a bunny. Kind of looks like a sex worker.
It's also Halloween.
That's
so
true.
Maybe they weren't aware of what day it was on the calendar.
I mean, even if they think she's a sex worker, that doesn't give them any right to like pick her up.
Yes.
I mean, that's, I'm not saying that they were in the right.
Yeah.
But they said that they abducted her, took her back to Selinsky's home, and kept her in a vault. And they allegedly assaulted her numerous times over the course of a few days and left her to die. This is all according to Weekly, again, a police informant.
Yeah, and those are always suspect. Usually they're looking to get something in return. Now, I would love to see a timeline of, was Michael Kirkowski already arrested by this time to where Weekly would know he was a criminal? Or was he naming this trusted town pharmacist as being involved when we later found out he was a criminal? I don't know the timeline there, but that would impact my opinion of how much to trust Paul Weekly. because of this information, police ended up obtaining a warrant to Selinsky's home. And when they got there, they made a horrific discovery. In the backyard of Selinsky's home, there were the burned remains of at least 5 bodies. Now, we've got Selinsky's name on our case list of something to cover at some time as a serial killer, and these 5 bodies need their own stories told, but it's just, yeah, they did stumble upon a serial killer. So Weekly knew at least a little bit of what he was talking about, apparently. By the time the investigators were able to excavate the backyard, they found the remains of 12 different people, including the remains of Michael Kirkowski, the pharmacist who was a drug dealer, and his girlfriend, Tammy Fassett. In that yard, they were able to identify all 12 people, and none of them were linked back to Cindy. Selinsky's lawyer would claim that his client had no knowledge at all of Cindy, and that he had no role at all in her disappearance. They actually found some witnesses that came forward to corroborate that Selinsky was in a different area than where Cindy was when she was abducted. So they were really trying to clear him of this. But, I mean, he's a serial killer. Not going to believe a lot of what he or his attorney say.
I mean, it's the closest thing to a lead they have in a year. And when they find, what did you say, a dozen bodies in the backyard? How do you not look at this as a very credible piece of information?
Absolutely.
Weekly's story started to fall apart a little bit. Originally, he said that Selinsky killed Kirkowski and Fawcett because Kirkowski kept Cindy's bunny ears as a souvenir of the murder. And this angered Selinsky and pushed him to murder. But it was soon uncovered that the real motive in Kirkowski's murder was money. Kirkowski had hidden $60,000 from Selinsky. Weekly eventually admitted that he helped murder Kirkowski and Fawcett because Selinsky promised him a cut of the hidden money for tipping him off.
Yeah, so Weekly obviously had some inside information on Selinsky, but why was he coming forward about Cindy if none of that actually happened? And maybe, again, he was just looking for a reason for them to search Selinsky's house, or maybe he was just looking for a lesser sentence on what he was doing. He was serving a life sentence at the time, and the death penalty was in front of him. So some people believe that he was just trying to get the death penalty taken off the table, and that's why he was coming forward. So then investigators decided, you're pretty chatty. You've obviously admitted to helping kill people. What do you potentially have to do with this? So they acquired and searched Weekly's computer, and they found a lot of articles about Cindy. So he had been, at the very least, researching her disappearance, and police thought that he might be looking up the details of her case in order to offer up false evidence in exchange for a reduced sentence or the death penalty taken off the table, what have you.
That makes sense, but it could also be that he was involved in some way and is very interested to know if police are close to getting him, you know?
Yeah, and we know that usually murderers, whether it's serial killers or not, sometimes have a fascination with the case. So they want to relive it as often as they can, and sometimes they do that through the media. So maybe he was just fascinated with her disappearance, and it was because he had something to do with it. Maybe he tried to give up Selinsky, and knowing that there were 12 people in his backyard, maybe he thought that Cindy Song's murder would just fall on Selinsky since he was a known killer. Unfortunately, investigators have never had enough evidence to prove that Weekly or Selinsky were involved in the disappearance of Cindy Song. There were no remains of her found in the backyard, and none of her possessions found in Selinsky's home or in Weekly's home. As of today, Cindy Song's case is still unsolved. We've covered really the police's theories here. The campus continues to say there was not enough done early on to find her, but there are no major leads at this point, aside from what we see here with Weekly and Selinsky, which is very, I don't know. There are a lot of holes in this theory and holes in their stories. The other two campus situations we've covered were individuals that were there was some resolution to those cases. People were found guilty for those crimes, but not in this one. And I'm afraid, John, that this is something that continues to happen of people just disappearing. And it is different with GPS and phones that are tracking us, whether it's an actual map app or any other apps that just want to know our locations all the time. But I think it's different now. But in 2001, disappearing was a lot easier, unfortunately. And I don't think she ran away. I think she was probably kidnapped by someone. I unfortunately don't think she's living anymore. But will we find this out? Or do you have another theory?
I personally think that this could very easily be the work of the people that Weekly talked about. I feel like just because you found 12 bodies at this house and none of them belong to Cindy, I don't think that eliminates him as a suspect. I think that it's very likely, but possible, that perhaps he murdered this poor girl and put her body somewhere else that we just haven't found yet.
Yep.
Her family did give DNA to CODIS, and her DNA profile's been registered with that for years, and there have been no bodies found that have matched her DNA yet. But, you know, who's to say that he buried those 12 in the yard and then he was like, you know what, I need to start putting my victims elsewhere. I'm running out of room. So she's buried somewhere that we just haven't found yet. So I think that this will be interesting when we eventually cover Gronkowski and Solinsky. We'll figure out more of what's in their minds when we cover that case.
Absolutely. And you're right. I mean, it could have been that situation where the yard was full and they went elsewhere, or maybe they had buried people elsewhere and decided to start using the yard. We don't know how many people he's killed. We'll dig into that more in his episode, but the number could be double that.
Yeah. And I mean, who knows? I mean, if this guy is the brutal killer that we think he is, who's to say he didn't pick her up and then she just never made it back to his house? I mean, it's awful. But what we do know is that Cindy, I'm going to say it's safe to presume that she was murdered. I don't think she ran away. I don't think she went somewhere and committed suicide. I think she went out for a quick errand or something that she needed at the store and then just never came home.
The Kristen Smart case is probably the case that's most similar to this one. But what makes it unique is that they did convict somebody of her murder and they think they know where her body ended up. And that took a journalist, a podcaster, to really be uber persistent on authorities and the suspect. Here we don't have that suspect was a citizen out living life. Here our suspects are already in prison, so I don't know that we're going to be able to pressure them into anything unless they are offered some kind of leniency in their sentence, which if they did kill her, we don't want them out of prison. So it's a tough situation when they're already serving life to try to get them to confess to something else, unless they're the type of killer who takes pride in what they do and want everybody to know. But I would think that would have come out in the last 21 years, and it hasn't.
Yeah. This is a fascinating case, and I pray that one day we will know with certainty what happened to Cindy. But until then, we're going to have more cases for you, and we'll keep you updated if there's something new on the case.
Yep, absolutely. If you happen to be in Happy Valley around this time in Pennsylvania and you know anything or heard anything, please contact authorities. Very much an open investigation, and if this does get any traction or we see any additional evidence come up or findings, we will absolutely share them with you here. And that's going to wrap up today's case. That's going to wrap up our little session here, our series of college student crimes committed against college students. We're going to revisit that down the road at some point because there are just too many, but we got some other stuff planned for the next few weeks that I'm super pumped about as well. So make sure you have subscribed and stay tuned.
Hopefully part of those plans are the return of my normal voice. Thank you for being patient with me today. And until next crime, this has been True Crimecast.
You've listened to True Crimecast. distributed by Stoveleg Media. Check out Stoveleg.com to find out more about your hosts and to find other podcasts to listen to. Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.